The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Anytime Fitness is for real people with real fitness goals. I mean, let's be honest. Most of us aren't training for marathons or half marathons or even half marathons. Only time most of us are running at all is if we're trying to make a connecting flight. Wouldn't have been late if we didn't stop to buy a headphone dongle. Point is, you gotta be ready. You do not want to deal with rebooking. Anytime Fitness, where real people help you make real progress. Join today and get a plan for training, nutrition, and recovery.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. Today's podcast is the second of an occasional series of interviews this spring addressing the life and work of Raphael Lemkin. Lemkin, as many of you already know, coined the term genocide in response to the catastrophic destruction of cultures and peoples in the first half of the 20th century, and in recognition that this was only the most recent set of examples of those kind of campaigns which have happened throughout human history. While his contributions have never been forgotten, there's been something of a renaissance of interest in Lemkin over the past decade. I'm thrilled to say that today I'm talking with Donnelly Fries, the editor of Lemkin's previously unpublished autobiography, totally unofficial, The Autobiography of Raphael Lemkin, published by Yale University Press. The book is, in some sense, incomplete, as Lemkin didn't finish it before his untimely death. But it offers readers a unique opportunity to understand his life and ideas. In addition, Donna is the editor of a recent special issue of the Journal of Genocide Research that re-examines Lemkin's work and ideas. I learned a lot from both of them, and I'm looking forward to talking with Donna about them. So, without any further introduction, Donna, thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. So let's just start by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in the field of genocide studies.
Well, I guess I came from out of field. I did a double major, undergraduate major in literature and philosophy. And I was very much interested in aftermath of trauma and representation of trauma. So even though I sort of merged into Holocaust studies at some stage after my undergraduate degree, but I also did a sub-major in film studies. So my PhD ended up being on genocide, film, and philosophy. So I'm a very interdisciplinary scholar. So, and genocide studies is a very interdisciplinary field, if you mm-hmm. could call it a field yet. It invites contributions from anthropology, sociology, law, philosophy, all areas. So it very much suits me as an academic to be in genocide studies. And I'm also very interested in testimony because I think it's very important to listen to voices of survivors of genocide.
So for those listeners who aren't really familiar with Lemkin, we'll get into his life in detail in a moment, but can you just say a few words about who he is and why he was important?
Well, I think why he is important Lemkin was born to a Polish Jewish family in 1900, had a fairly sort of unremarkable childhood, a very rural childhood. Grew up on a farm with his family and his cousins and his aunts and uncles and two brothers. But according to Lemkin's account, he became very interested in the destruction of people at a very young age. It made him want to sort of go into learn languages. He's very interested in culture. But there were a lot of circumstances in Lincoln's life that made him change to law. He tried to outlaw what was known as acts of barbarity and acts of vandalism in 1933, which are embryonic forms of genocide as we know it today. He was unsuccessful. In 1933, Hitler came to power, and there are a whole lot of reasons why this act never came into fruition. And then basically the Nazis invaded his home in Poland in 1939. He escaped. He came to America. And while his family, his mother and father in particular, were gassed at Treblinka, he coined the word genocide. And he fought. He sort of became an activist after this rather than a scholar, I think driven on by grief, and made sure that genocide became a crime under international law. And he died alone and in poverty at the age of 59. So it's as Robert J. Lifton has said, it's a strangely hopeful tale, but it's also a tragic tale as well.
So I mentioned in the introduction, he's never been completely ignored, but there's been a resurgence of interest in him and his life and his ideas in the past decade or so. Why has that been?
Well, I'm not sure that I agree that he's been ignored. I think he was ignored. I mean, genocide scholars, and bless them, they did amazing work when they first began in the late 80s and early 90s, predominantly sociologists. But he was ignored. Lemkin was primarily ignored. I mean, people had mentioned him, that the word genocide was coined from him, but his ideas were ignored. And I think what has happened, certainly since around 2005 to 2007, let's say, Lemkin's ideas have begun to made an impact on the scholarship. So while I think perhaps Lemkin himself wasn't ignored, I believe that his ideas and his thought and his processes as an intellectual and an academic had been ignored completely. So I think this is what the resurgence is. People are interested in what he had to say as an academic, as a lawyer, as a historian, as a cultural theorist. Because, you know, he's known as being a lawyer, but he was probably the first historian of genocide studies. So I think this is what's happened, and I think this is people that looked at him and said, this man has a trove of archives with loads of academic and scholarly writings that people have ignored, and so I think this is what's happened.
So why did you decide to take part in this?
Well, it was partly coincidental and partly out of rage. I received a scholarship from the Jewish Holocaust Centre in Melbourne in Australia to go to Lemkin's archives because I knew that there were a lot of his scholarly ideas there. And I wasn't the first to discover this, but I did discover that there was this manuscript sitting there that had been unpublished. And so many people had spoken on Lemkin's behalf, and this was Lemkin's voice about his life. And I looked at the manuscript, which was many, many pages of particular chapters, some handwritten, and I can see why scholars had looked at this and thought, I can't do this, it's just too much. And I came home and I brought the manuscript home with me, and I was speaking to colleagues about it, and I said, I'm outraged that this has not been published before. And I thought, well, I can't sit back and say, well, I'm outraged and not do anything about it. So I spent the next 4.5 to 5 years of my life transcribing and editing the volume. So it was hard work. My eyesight deteriorated, but my struggle was minimal compared to Lemkin, so it was very rewarding in the end. And I'm very glad that Lemkin's voice is out there.
Yeah. So why does he write this autobiography?
That's a really interesting question, Kelly, because and one that I haven't actually been asked before. I think that Lemkin saw the life of the Genocide Convention, not his role in it so much, but the actual convention, which he sort of animates as a almost in human terms. I mean, he calls it his baby. He says, so the Genocide Convention and I went off to Paris together, and you know, he's and I think he sees this convention as something that was larger than him. And I say in the introduction to the autobiography that maybe it shouldn't be called an autobiography, because in some ways it is a biography of the Genocide Convention. Mm. It starts off as an autobiography of Lemkin, and in a very sentimental way, I must say, but it becomes something larger than Lemkin. It becomes a journey of what happens to this convention before it's a convention, so in vitro, and then its birth. I mean, he talks about it in these terms. You know, people are trying to abort the Genocide Convention. Mm-hmm. So I think he saw that the convention as something, as a sign of hope for humankind. Yeah. So I think that's why he wrote it. But, you know, I'm not Lemkin's biographer. I'm merely the editor of his autobiography. So,
so in the autobiography,
yeah,
or the biography of the convention, however you want to portray it,
yeah,
what does he say about his early life? Or maybe let me ask it this way.
Yeah.
Is there something in his early experience that creates this driving passion about human rights and about mass violence in his early years, or is that a creation of the middle period of his life?
Well, there's two answers to that. There's the interpretation of me as a reader, and it's Lemkin's ideas on this. I think, you know, his mother influenced him. She told him a lot of stories and fables and songs. I think growing up in a somewhat multicultural, for want of a better word, environment, where he certainly portrays his early childhood as harmonious, living among Polish farmhands, and having a Jewish identity. It sounds from his accent that his first language was Yiddish, but I can't be 100% sure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this Yiddishkeit upbringing as well. But I think also he was a very empathic child. He was a deep intellectual and empathic child. But I have to say the thing that really struck me was that in 1915, the Germans invaded his hometown in eastern Poland. But the event of 1915 that actually impacted on Lemkin more than that was the Armenian Genocide. So it's a remarkable thing that this occurrence that's happening in another part of the world affects him a lot more than what is happening to his hometown and also to his home. I believe that his farm was burnt down during 1915 as well. So he was certainly struck that of punity of the Armenian Genocide as well. And this happened later in the trial of the Ottoman Turks. But he was shocked and stunned that somebody could be convicted for the homicide or the killing of one man or one person, but there was impunity for the destruction of a group of people. So I think this is the Armenian Genocide, I think more than, certainly up until 1945, more than anything else really, really altered his stayed with him, altered his imagination and his legal mind around this issue. And it was the genocide that he brought up every time he needed to explain what genocide was. So for Lemkin, I think it was probably a few variables, but I certainly would say the Armenian Genocide is the key. Caven.
So you mentioned his background a little bit earlier, and he has this kind of idyllic, or presented anyway in his in his biography, his idyllic. In the 1930s, he's become quite successful. What's he doing in that period, and how does he get there?
Okay, well, this is a very mysterious part of Lincoln's life because he actually doesn't write a lot about it. It's one that I'm the most curious about. I think Lincoln's quite embarrassed about this period of his life because he's quite wealthy. I'm reading between the lines. I think he had a country home. He was a very successful deputy prosecutor of Warsaw. He was producing a book a year. And I think he feels guilty about this part of his life, which is possibly why he doesn't write about it a lot. Because when he's escaping as an internally displaced refugee in his own hometown in Poland in 1939, it's then he decides that he wants to be empowered to stop this heinous scourge that's about to occur to Poland. Lincoln is very mysterious about a lot of things in his life. For instance, I know that his youngest brother dies when Lincoln's about 21 from the Spanish flu. It's not even mentioned. But the 1930s, you know, I'm curious, what was life like for a Jewish public prosecutor in Warsaw in the 1930s? Mm-hmm. He doesn't say.
And as I read the memoir, I have to say, even if he had, so for those of you who don't know the story, right, he's, the Germans invade in 1939 and he's forced to flee, and he has this astonishing journey to the United States that even if he had not gone on to introduce the convention and managed to get the convention passed, I think I still would have read this book just to read the story about this trip. Can you talk about the trip? How did he get to the United States?
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite parts of the book because it reads, I don't know what it was like for you, Kelly, but for me, even though I've read it a lot of times, it reads like an adventure story to me.
Yeah.
I kind of, even though I know what's going to happen, I'm still sort of sitting on the edge of my seat and thinking. Mm-hmm. He's a beautiful writer, and I think his writing comes out really well in these passages. But the way Lincoln describes it is that the Germans invaded Warsaw. There's orders for all able-bodied men to escape Warsaw. So he takes a shaving kit and his glasses, and he goes to the station, which is crowded with a sea of people, and people are wailing and crying. Then the train is bombed. And then he's basically living out in the forest with other internally displaced refugees. And mostly following the Polish army, who are almost defeated, as Lincoln describes, defeated even before battle. Mm-hmm. And eventually he realizes that he must go and see his parents, which is in another part of Poland, but he has to actually pass through Russian patrols, and he knows, he's smart enough, he knows his area well enough to know that he can't go there with his city eyeglasses and his smooth hands, and he's got to talk like a Russian peasant, basically, and act like one. So he tries to cross this border, and the Russians are very suspicious of him. So they keep him overnight, and he does eventually escape, but he acts like one of these Russian peasants. He does escape, and then there's this really moving passage where he spends a week in a shtetl, which is a Eastern European Jewish village, a religious village, Jewish village, with a Jewish baker, and he tries to convince this baker that what is about to occur is not war. It's something different to war. And the Jewish baker is not convinced. He said, you know, for us Jews, we have to suffer, and this is our way of life. The Germans have come here before. The Germans need us. You know, I need to bake their bread for them. And Lincoln says, no, this is not. This is different. This is something else. This is destruction. Have you not heard of Mein Kampf? And the baker says, well, even if I had, I still wouldn't believe that people want to eradicate or destroy the Jews. Mm. Lemkin goes to sleep that night and he hears this wailing of a sound and he realizes it's the baker having this dialogue with God. And it's a very, very moving passage because later Lemkin is a advisor to the American prosecution at Nuremberg and there's a massacre in this village where Lemkin stayed with this baker and he recalls the testament at Nuremberg and the baker's wailing to God. Anyway, eventually Lemkin does escape from there and family and he tries to convince his parents to come along with him. But it sounds to me like they were too old and too frail to do that. Probably, yeah. And they encourage him to go to America to pursue his idea of this genocide convention. But it's not called a genocide convention at this stage because Lemkin hadn't coined a term for it yet. And eventually he gets help because he was a very influential lawyer in Poland in the 1930s. So he has a lot of international friends who are high up in European legal circles. So he gets passage to Sweden eventually where he lectures at the University of Stockholm for a year. And one of his other colleagues who he co-wrote a book with in the 1930s was a man called Malcolm McDermott from Duke University in North Carolina. And he eventually gets Lemkin a job at Duke University. So Lemkin arrives in 1941. But it's an extraordinary passage. He goes through Russia and Japan and he makes these extraordinary cultural observations of these countries at the time. And then he arrives in sunny North Carolina and it's a very strange place for this Polish Jew to end up. But it's, yes, they're wonderful passages, yes.
Yeah, it's an amazing story.
Yeah.
And then as you say, or at least as I read it, It changes direction. If it was perhaps his autobiography more or less before that, it quite quickly becomes a biography of the convention from that point forward. Mm-hmm. And can you say something about how he envisioned this? How does he, at least as he writes about it, how does he hope, what does he hope will happen, and who does he see as his opponents in getting the convention passed and implemented?
Well, it's interesting. When one is writing one's autobiography, one always knows the ending.
Yes.
So he knew what was going to happen while he was writing this, but or what had already happened. I find it very interesting that a lot of portraits of Lemkin portray him as naive and and I actually find that Lemkin is anything but that. He, certainly the way he portrays his story, he knew that what he called were so-called snakes, the snakes, the politicians that were out to sort of destroy the Genocide Convention. He was one step ahead of him. And what I mean by one step, one legal step, he could outwit them legally every time. It seems to me that that's what happened. He was very astute he could portray himself as naive and to a lot of these people, but there was also a side of him that was very, very, very passionate about this as well. So I think a combination of his passion and his intellect, drove him. But of course, his aim was to have an international legal convention that would include the outlawing of the destruction of particular groups, and through particular methods. And those methods were physical, biological, and cultural. And some of your listeners may or may not know, the cultural aspects of the Genocide Convention never came through, and that was Lemkin's most disappointing time, I think, during this. However, I would argue that it's impossible to destroy a group physically without destroying it culturally anyway. So to me, cultural genocide is inherent within the whole concept of genocide anyway. And it's very interesting because even though there was a legal definition of genocide after 1951 or 1948 to 1951, Lemkin still understood genocide as a destruction of the cultural qualities or personalities of a particular group. Lemkin was in the 1940s. These concepts of groups is very difficult for a lot of historians and sociologists and anthropologists today as well. I mean, is it so easy to divide human beings into groups, particular groups now? I mean, that is problematic. The Genocide Convention then was of racial groups, ethnical groups, racial, ethnic, religious groups. And, you know, those groups are fluid. They're very fluid now. But I'm going a little bit off topic, I'm sorry. But, look, I think really Lemkin's aim was to get this as an international legal convention, and that's what he got.
He presents himself, at least as I read it, driven is a word that's perhaps an underestimate of the way he present that I read his character in this, wedded to a particular vision, devoted to a cause. How did his contemporaries view him?
Well, Lemkin was a very, very intuitive person. And I think the concept of intuition in males in the 1940s and 1950s was frowned upon. Maybe it still is. I'm not sure. and he used what he called a lot of horse sense in this as well.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that surprised me about reading this, and I know that this is Lemkin portraying himself, but it's also me doing a lot of archival reading about people who had met Lemkin. Mm-hmm. He was admired. A lot of people admired him, admired his drive. They did think he was obsessed with this idea. There are certainly a lot of people from places that you would not expect a Polish Jew at that time to befriend, people from Pakistan, India, mm-hmm. Cuba, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, the Philippines. I have to say the Australians, I also loved him. I loved him a lot. And it would depend, I think, upon people's political disposition towards the Genocide Convention.
Yeah.
I think he was seen as a great humanitarian by many.
Did he think of himself as an insider or an outsider?
Oh, definitely an insider. An outsider. Mm-hmm. Yeah, without a doubt. No, he never. I don't think he ever felt comfortable. There is one passage where I have to say he's in the Australian delegates' lounge, and you know he says he couldn't be more comfortable. He felt more comfortable than he did with even his family. I mean, that's an extraordinary statement to make.
Yeah.
He was always on the periphery. He didn't belong to any organization. He always had adjunct positions at universities. His brother, his only surviving relative, his brother lived in Canada. He was very, very much an outsider. He didn't belong, but he was a very, very spiritual person. He belonged within himself. He wrote a lot of poetry, a lot of very bad poetry, I have to say, but he did read a lot of poetry as well, and he felt very comfortable being not lonely, but alone. It gave him strength. It gave him a lot of strength. Yeah.
I just interviewed Steve Jacobs,
right.
Who, for those of you who don't know, edited Lemkin's at that time, unpublished history of genocide. He's just edited it and published it. And I asked him a question I'd like to ask you, and it's not directly in the book you've edited, but there are hints at it. What did Lemkin think of the world around him? Was he optimistic about his world or pessimistic?
Oh, I'd love to know what Steve said about that. I'll have to listen to the podcast.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
I will. I think he was a pessimist. And look, he's strange. No, I'll take that back, Kelly. I think he saw himself as a pessimist. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anybody could have done what he did. What he managed to do with that convention and get that through the United Nations as a pessimist. You had to have hope. He had to get up every morning and, you know, he had an uphill battle every morning to get this, to convince delegates every day that this was an important piece of legislation that had to be passed. A total pessimist couldn't do that. Maybe a realist. I'd like to call him a realist. Mm-hmm. He had hope. He was despondent, but he was realistic as well. I will just say what Steve said about that.
Did he work himself to death?
Possibly. He possibly did. Mm. Although I was just speaking to a colleague the other day, because Lemkin really didn't have a job in the last few years of his life, and I don't know why. He lived around the corner from Cambridge University. You know, there's a Cambridge Law School.
Yeah.
I don't know if he didn't want to work or he was so disheveled and that he probably didn't feel he could go for an interview. Although the woman that knew him in the last 2 years of his life, Nancy Stason Ehrlich, who is still living in Brooklyn today, she met him as a 22-year-old at Riverside Park, and she said he was delightful company. She said she knew that he wasn't well. She didn't know what was wrong with him, but she said he was humorous and he was a lot of fun to be around. I mean, this is not an image that we have of Lemkin, a lot of fun to be around, but this is what she said about him. Did he work himself to death? Yes, he possibly did. But there was a history of high blood pressure in his family. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there were lots of times when he was working so hard on the Genocide Convention that he couldn't work, so he couldn't eat nutritious food. I would say possibly yes.
So we're running a little bit short on time. I know you have a schedule you have to keep, but can I ask you just for a minute to maybe say something about the special issue of the journal you edited and why now is the right time for that kind of devoted special issue on Lemkin to come out and what you were hoping to do with that?
Well, it was born out of an international conference held at the Center for Jewish History in New York in 2009. Where we have scholars from around the world talking about Lemkin as a scholar of law, of history, and of cultural studies as well. So I'm possibly right in saying that this is, you know, a conference that kick-started Lemkin not just as the person who coined the word genocide, but going back to what I originally said at the beginning of the interview, as someone who actually had intellectual ideas about history and culture and anthropology and psychology. And so the special issue was really born from this conference. And even though only one contributor, Hilary Earle, contributed to the conference and the journal, Dirk Moses and I found was that by the time we came around to publishing this, there were younger scholars coming up who were looking at Lemkin's ideas. So we just thought this was the right time to give these scholars a platform because they were doing something that us mid-range and older scholars weren't doing, and that is looking at Lemkin as a historian and as someone who was interested in cultural history and had all these intellectual contributions to make to genocide studies that had been ignored. So that's why I found the special issue really exciting, to have a platform for these young scholars who are brilliant and are, you know, are going to be the next generation of great genocide study scholars.
Oh, it was wonderfully interesting to read, and I learned a lot from it. And
yes, me too, actually.
That's always the joy of being an editor, I imagine, is that you get to learn.
Yes, absolutely.
So we've taken a lot of your time. Just if I could wrap up.
Yeah.
What are you doing now?
Well, I'm finishing off a fellowship in the last 6 months at the Center for Jewish History, and I'm actually listening to a bank of audio tapes of Austrian child Holocaust survivors.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that are held at the Leo Beck Institute at the Center for Jewish History. I'm also writing a history of the Jewish Holocaust Center in Melbourne, Australia, which is a very unique. I'll give it a plug here. I'm happy to give it a plug.
Yeah,
it's
please.
A very unique Holocaust museum that is run predominantly by Polish survivor community in Melbourne. So hopefully that's going to be published in 2014. And I've got lots of other little things on the go as well.
Things that we think are little often turns into big things,
that's
I've
right,
found.
Exactly. Well, it's all great.
Well, Donna, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I appreciate it so much, and I hope somewhere down the line that we'll get a chance to talk to you again on the show.
Wonderful. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, Kelly.
You've been listening to an interview with Donna Lee Fries, editor of the new work, Totally Unofficial, the autobiography of Raphael Lemkin, published by Yale University Press. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time for an interview with Susan Thompson, author of Whispering Truth to Power, Everyday Resistance to Reconciliation in Post-Genocide Rwanda. Until then, have a great month.